Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And a few housekeeping notes before we get to our monsters of the day. I've got my new book of short stories titled O Monstrous World, published by Press 53. The official release date is March 15th. And so if you are listening to this podcast the day it's released, the official release date of that book is today. You can find it on Press 53's website, also available on Amazon.com. And I've got a few book tour events in areas near where I live. One of those coming up March 22nd in Evansville, Indiana. The University of Evansville is having me in for their coffee hour reading series. That's going to be in the Melvin Peterson Gallery, right there or right across the street from the U of E campus. That's at 4 p.m. that Friday, March 22nd. Free and open to the public, of course. Got another one at Kaskaskia College in Centralia, Illinois. That one is on April 9th in the afternoon, 2:30 to 3:30. And that one's going to be in the Lifelong Learning Center on the campus. And I also get to be a part of the Little Grassy Literary Festival. That's at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, in Carbondale, Illinois. That goes on from April 10th through April 12th. So it's a Wednesday evening and all day Thursday and a Friday till noon. I'm opening the festival with a reading at 6 p.m. That's April 10th. That's in the Morris Library there on campus, SIUC. Also be involved in a book signing, book sale event Thursday. Probably be at all those other readings as well. And then Friday, April 12th, I'll be on a panel there at 10 a.m. there in the Morris Library. The panel on the writing life. And so these are to help promote my book, O Monstrous World, an excellent one. Check it out. But I hope we also get far beyond and deeper than anything I wrote in some of these discussions. We always seem to. Anytime I attend one of these events, people bring up some excellent questions, some excellent points. We end up getting into some cool discussions about storytelling in general, about myth making, maybe even a little bit about monsters themselves. All these events are free and open to the public, so you are invited and welcomed. So with all that said, today I want to talk about ringwraiths and barrow whites. I'm sure to many of you, upon hearing that I want to talk about ringwraiths and barrow whites, immediately know where that comes from. Both of those are monsters that feature in J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. I think both of them are brilliant inventions by Tolkien. And I wanted to originally talk about one aspect of barrow whites that has struck me recently and I put together, but as I kept putting together my notes on it and I kept thinking about it more, it turned into a scholarly paper that I've now completed and sent off to places like Tolkien Studies. So I'll wait on all of those points to see whether the paper gets published first. If it doesn't, I'll just tell you everything on one of these episodes. If it does, I think it's fair to let the publishers have first whack at it since I've already sent it to them. But then I realized I don't have to wait until talking about barrow whites and ring wraiths till later. I can just, by the time I just get into the basics, I'll fill up a whole episode. And so that's where I want to start today. So those of you who are familiar with Peter Jackson's movie versions of The Lord of the Rings probably have a pretty good image in your mind of what a ringwraith looks like. This cloaked figure, kind of Grim Reaper-like, who seems to have no clear face deep under the hood. It's all covered in shadow, maybe these scary gothic metal gauntlets, and they'll ride these black horses. And then later in the films, they'll ride these fell creatures with large leathery wings that look kind of like flying dinosaurs. That's all pretty close to how they're described in the book. You might not be familiar with Barrow-wights because they didn't make it into the movie, but the poor little hobbits encounter those guys pretty early in the book. They haven't even gotten all the way to Bree yet. And so they're still in what they consider relatively safe territory when they get captured by these undead creatures, one of them in particular, living under these barrows. So in this scene, the hobbits go to these, they're past the Old Forest, farther west than the Old Forest, and they're in the Barrow Downs, and this mist and fog rises up, and they fall asleep in this place, and they wake up, and they're captured inside a burial chamber under a hill with this undead creature. It has dressed them, has removed their clothes and dressed them in a different, strange kind of funeral gown. It has all these, like, these ancient treasures all around them and decorated these hobbits with them. And there's this undead skeletal figure singing or croaking out this creepy old poem. I'll just read it to you. Cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep under stone, never more to wake on stony bed, never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. In the black wind the stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie, till the dark lord lifts his hand over dead sea and withered land. That's pretty cool and creepy, and a bad thing to wake up to one morning if you find yourself redressed and then trapped in somewhere and someone's over you singing that. So if you listen to that and that felt really old to you, like it sounds legitimately like old poetry or a translation of something old, well, there's a reason for that. In that song of the Barrow-wight, you get only words of Old English or Germanic origin. Of course, English is, of course, a Germanic language. And then later in its history, it started importing words and parts of the language from the Romantic languages, especially after the Norman invasion, where we get a whole bunch of Norman French Latinate words coming in, and then later a bunch of other Greek words as well. It's a convoluted and complex history, but originally it was pretty purely Germanic, and those words that sound most basic, most simple to us, such as heart and home and fire. These are words that derive from Old English and have been around since then. So in that song, you'll get none of the many, many Latinate words in our language. You only get the Old English Germanic words. Cold be heart and hand and stone. Even the name Barrow-wights themselves, that's an oddly old English term. The barrow is nothing new to a lot of us. It's like a burial mound, this created mound in which you put some revered dead hero, king, queen, something like that. You put them in the ground like a primitive pyramid, along with a lot of their possessions or treasures. So that's a barrow. But what is this white? Since this character in Lord of the Rings, white has taken this meaning of like this ghoul, this undead graveyard, ghoulish, zombie-like, ghost-like figure. And that shows up, for instance, in the Dungeons and Dragons role-playing game. In the Monstrous Manual, you'll get information about wights that lurk around graveyards. They show up in video games as well. I'm sure movies as well have included wights. But white as this type of graveyard ghoul did not exist before that chapter in Lord of the Rings. White just simply meant guy, as we would translate it now, although guy would be a completely different etymology altogether off of Guy Fawkes. But white just meant like a very, very general term for person, fella. It can even refer to women. It was such a general term. And so to call these things barrow whites are just like, it's kind of like calling them like a grave guys, something like that. It's this really general kind of thing, but it's specifically Old English. And so clearly Tolkien had in mind the Old English burial mounds and the feel of this really old thing. So first I want to get into a little bit of where, like more specifically on that influence, and then a little bit of history on these barrow whites. So if you take, say, a map of one of Tolkien's maps of Middle Earth, and you orient that over Europe, and you take a few years ago, and this story came out that someone found a note handwritten on the back of one of these maps that was involved in some of the publication drafts, in which Tolkien mentions Hobbiton and Oxford as being similar or the same kind of pinpoint. If you take that kind of as a map legend, you take that map and you lay it, you get the scale, two scale right for both maps, Middle Earth and Europe, and you place Hobbiton directly over Oxford in England, you find a whole bunch of really interesting things. To the west, where the gray havens lie in Middle Earth, you'll find that's exactly these havens in Wessex. Or not Wessex. Oh, I've already forgotten. Anyway, on the west coast of England. And then if you look farther to the east, where the Barrow Downs are in Middle Earth, where these Barrow Whites are buried under these mounds, you find exactly that's where the burial mounds of Sutton Hoo are. Now, if you're already familiar with Sutton Hoo, you know how cool that is. If not, you should check it out. Like, get on Wikipedia and look up Sutton Hoo. Sutton Hoo, two separate words, it's this amazing archaeological site in the east of England. I guess that would be Essex, East Saxon land, Essex. I think it's over, I forget exactly where they call it, but it's on the far east of England. And these burial mounds, you might be familiar with one famous piece that they pulled out of there, this beautiful old English helmet mask combination with this like metal mustache and these blank eyes and this like small pointy chin. It's this beautiful mask helmet image. That's straight out of the Sutton Hoo burial grounds, and that's a glimpse into the world of, say, Beowulf, for instance. So these burial mounds in Lord of the Rings, not only linguistically and kind of through description match up with Sutton Hoo, but even the map suggests that both of these things are in Tolkien's mind at once. Now, the weird thing, though, would be that these guys are evil undead, and Tolkien wouldn't really want to do that with old English heroes and kings who were buried in these mounds. So in his world, in the Lord of the Rings story world, who are these barrow whites and why are they? I mean, how could these good kings of men now be evil? Well, there's backstory behind that, just like there's backstory to everything in Lord of the Rings. These were actually originally very ancient king. Well, the burial mounds started off as very, very ancient kings, all the way up to more recent kings. And the burial mound that the hobbits find themselves in actually ends up being the burial mound of the last of the royal line of soldiers and warriors in that area on Middle Earth. And this was the burial mound of the last prince of Cardolan, which was one of the northern kingdoms that no longer exists by the time the book picks up. And so these were all the burial mounds of noble, forthright warriors and royalty. So how did they turn evil? Well, it turns out that many, many, many years ago, the Witch King of Angmar sent out evil spirits to possess these mounds, the mounds, the revered mounds of his enemy. We'll get more into who's the Witch King of Angmar in a second, but he sent these evil spirits to possess these mounds and to possess the corpses of their revered kings. In fact, the Witch King himself killed this last prince of Cardolan. And so that this white is the body of somebody that the Witch King himself killed, but that's not his spirit animating it. It's some other evil spirit sent in there. Now, why would the bad guys do something like that, go in and possess the revered burial grounds of their enemy? If nothing else, that's got to be a little bit demoralizing. Maybe it's a flag planting moment, but that would be like whoever is, I don't know, whoever of the many enemies that the United States might have right now, just imagine any one of them and sneaking in and like placing machine guns in the eyes of the Lincoln Memorial statue. And so we've got this revered leader of America and people go to see this thing and to have some feeling of honor about, say, Abraham Lincoln. And then it just starts shooting out of its eyes at them. That would be the bizarre equivalent of what happened with these barrel whites. Like, you take something that was once good and you turn it into this evil thing. And so it seems to have these in the chapter and the aftermath after the hobbits are saved from this barrel white, there seem to be like these lingering memories of long lost battles that remain in the barrow or that the barrow whites still have, but they're these different things. And in fact, only recently in this storyline were these barrow whites woken up. They were sleeping and inanimate, and the Witch King rode by and woke them up not too many days before the hobbits are captured by one. So who is the Witch King then? Well, he is the chief of the Ringwraiths. There are 9 of them, and we know about 2 of them. We know like what their names were, or essentially what they're called, and a little bit about them. And one of the 2 we know about, the one we know most about, their leader, is the Witch King of Angmar. And my God, we're 18 minutes into this podcast, and I'm just now getting to the Ringwraiths. Oh no. Man, am I going to? Okay, keep going. Focus. Okay, so the Ringwraiths, there are 9 of these guys, and they were once warriors, kings of men, sorcerers themselves, of a race of high and noble kings that were even slightly different than normal men, in that they lived longer, they were taller, they were more capable and powerful. And Sauron had created the Rings of Power. There were, well, Sauron and an elf, Celebrimbor, together created Rings of Power, and they created 7, gave them to the dwarves. They created 9, and well, Sauron gave them to the dwarves, and then 9, and Sauron gave them to men so as to corrupt them. Essentially, these Rings of Power would have the benefit of helping you gain power. It also had The side effect, however, of slowly turning you into a soulless wraith under the command of the Dark Lord, and that's a certain price to pay for gaining ultimate power in the world. By the time we see these ring wraiths in the book, they are long, long since lost. They have nothing left of what was once their individualism, themselves as men, and now they are these soulless, ghost-like things that have no true will of their own. How old are these ring wraiths? They're at the youngest, they're just over 2,000 years old. But there's plenty of reason to believe that they're much, much older than that. Sauron created the Rings of Power, let's see, about 4,800 years before the events that take place in the tale of the Lord of the Rings in the narrative proper. And so not too long after that, the ring wraiths would have gotten hold, or the men would have gotten hold of the nine rings of men and slowly started becoming ring wraiths. So at least for 2,000 years, they're pretty darn old. And they managed to become this, these rings kept them from dying, and it kept them from losing mortality, but it didn't necessarily give them life. It just stretched out their years and years and years until they're empty and hollow and essentially invisible if they don't put on raiment and concrete form. They are these invisible ghost-like creatures that can pass along, and then they have this this aura of terror about them, more so when they're invisible than when you can see them. And so when they're passing along invisibly, say past some village, as it says in notes in the Unfinished Tales, J.R.R. Tolkien's Unfinished Tales, on their way northwest, they pass villages and whole peoples scream and panic and just flee their home, never to return. That's how much terror follows these wraiths. When they put on these forms of cloaked riders, and they get on some of these specially trained evil horses, and they start scouring the Shire, trying to find whoever this Baggins is who must have the One Ring. And so they put on the forms that they think will be least terrifying to other people, and they try not to reveal what they really are or how terrifying they really are. And so that's why, in part, the different hobbits that they talk to don't just immediately go insane or scream and run in terror. They're trying to hold that back, and they do a semi-decent job of that. But when they reveal themselves in full terror, they're something to behold. I said there were nine of them, and we know about two. One of them is the Witch King of Angmar. Angmar was this kingdom in the north of Middle-earth, and it was a stronghold that was, it was kind of a lesser junior version of what was once the true stronghold of evil farther in North Angband, where Morgoth, the true Dark Lord, had his base, his fortress, and that's where he created many evil things and sent out from. And so many hundreds, if not thousands of years later, the Witch King sets up a place kind of like that up north. By the way, this Morgoth, the true Dark Lord, Sauron was just like an eighth lieutenant down the line of power in servitude to Morgoth. You know what? That's getting way off track. Back on track. Focus on this. This is kind of how the Tolkien literature class goes that I teach, by the way, if you're wondering. I wonder what it's like to take a literature class with him. It's a whole bunch of frantic. And it's like, and this, and this, and isn't this cool? And having trouble focusing. So the students leave with a whole bunch of information and God knows what else they leave with. We do have some interesting discussions, but I think I do have the weakness of trying to overload and get off track. Okay, so where was I? The Witch King of Angmar. Yeah, he was this terrifying warlord for many, many years. In the story, a Strider takes the hobbits up to this place called Weathertop, and he explains that it's now in ruins, but once it was this mighty fortress, this mighty watchtower. And it was mighty in many ways, in part because it was at the time essentially unassailable, kind of like the walls of Ilium and Troy. And another is that it held a special treasure, this Palantir, one of several seeing stones. And that's a treasure beyond price in the story world of Lord of the Rings. And the reason why it is razed to the ground and nothing but ruins is because of the attack of the Witch King. He originally wanted to start breaking down the strong kingdoms of men who were too strong, essentially, for the dark forces. Sauron himself is overthrown three times. It depends on how you count. Anyway, the Witch King wanted to start breaking up the kingdoms. The Gondor in the south was too strong, but the northern ones were kind of fractured because of inside politics. And so he decided to set up north and start breaking them apart from there. And so he ends up gaining some evil allies and building up his forces, and then he attacks and he ends up breaking the kingdoms apart. He's the reason why there's no northern kingdom anymore. There's nothing but like wandering bands of rangers left of these once noble kings. And so he ends up staging this attack on Weathertop, the one that takes the longest, but he finally breaks it and razes it to the ground and leaves it in nothing but ruins. He never did get his hand on the Palantir, by the way. The men managed to sneak that out in their escape. And it's a very Troy-like escape with Aeneas and Chryses, his father, instead. It's one of Strider's ancestors who escapes with two specific heirlooms. And that's where also the Witch King slaughters this last prince of this North Kingdom. And that's where this prince is buried, in the burial mounds. And as they're searching much, much later in the narrative of Lord of the Rings, as the Ringwraiths are searching for this halfling named Baggin somewhere in this strange area, he stirred the Barrow-wights awake as one other line of defense to make sure nothing escapes farther west than the Barrows. And the hobbits almost don't make it out. They're saved by the enigmatic and joyful character Tom Bombadil. And if all you are familiar with are the movies, the Peter Jackson movies, then you have no idea who Tom Bombadil is. He will be quite a surprise to you the day you pick up the books. He's a delight. There are a lot of reasons for reading the book. Not only just the differences between the books and the movies, but there are a whole lot of different kinds of pleasures that can be found. If nothing else, Tom Bombadil and the Barrow-wights are a couple. So who's this other Ringwraith that we know about specifically? Well, there is a second one. He's not named or discussed much in the Lord of the Rings text itself, and any additions even in the appendices, but in supplemental texts such as Unfinished Tales, a bunch of notes and unfinished stories that Tolkien had been working on, edited together with notes and explanations by his son, who was in charge of the estate, Christopher Tolkien. In Unfinished Tales, it tells us a whole lot more about at least one of these Ringwraiths. And his name is Camul, the Black Easterling, also known as Camul, the Shadow of the East. and he is a second chief, as Tolkien describes him. Although seven of the Ringwraiths in the story come up from the south, this terrible fortress called Minas Morgul, down across the river from Minas Tirith, right near Osgiliath. Although seven of them head northwest to search for the ring, Camul and his assistant Ringwraith are up northwest in Dol Guldur, which is in Mirkwood, which is just to the east of the Misty Mountains. That's where he's been hanging out for a long time. And Camul ends up getting over to the Shire first, and he's the one who talks with a couple of the hobbits, Gaffer Gamgee and Farmer Maggot, asking about where this Baggins is. He's the one who first sniffs out the hobbits on the road and is stopped at Buckleberry Ferry because he can't cross the water. We'll have to talk about that in a second, like what's up with the water thing and what's up with the sniffing. There is a little bit more information on all of that, but Camul the Black Easterling is this guy. And so where does he come from, or why do they call him the Black Easterling or the Shadow of the East? He comes from some far eastern land, some warrior sorcerer over there, somewhere far east off the maps that any of us have received through Tolkien or otherwise. And Camul, you can see in his name this sense of this Middle Eastern or Far East style. It's K-H-A-M-U with the thing over it and then L. Camul. I think it's an awesome name. You know what? Oh my God, we're half an hour into this thing and I haven't even really discussed like maybe deeper meetings of this. I'd like to do that at least in one show. Every show, I'd like to get at least a little bit of like maybe deeper analysis into these monsters, and then at least one hint on how to fight them if you have to. And so how about like I jump to both, and then maybe we can circle back to the sniffing and this fear of water and stuff. I think one of the best readings of what makes the Ringwraith so interesting and perhaps significant in our era is offered forth by the great Tom Shippey, a scholar of many different aspects, of many different elements of literature, Middle English, Old English, a whole bunch of medieval literature, a whole bunch of languages. He used to teach over at St. Louis University. He has since moved back to his home in England, although he's originally went to school in Scotland. Anyway, so he in one of his books, and I think this one is Author of the Century, his book on Tolkien, essentially being one of the authors, if not the author of the 20th century, he brings up that while a lot of features of these Ringwraiths would have made sense to readers of the past, there is a fundamental aspect to them that doesn't quite hold until we get to readers of the 20th century, especially the post-World War readers, which is what Tolkien has, essentially. This idea that once perhaps noble, if nothing else, powerful, and high-ranking men are tempted into power and take that temptation, and for their striving for power, they become hollowed out, soulless, and eventually have no true will of their own and end up being kind of puppets. So how can you have all this immense, terrifying power and simultaneously be a puppet of something else or some other force? How can you be so great and yet be completely hollow and empty on the inside? Well, anybody in the at least last half, if not the early part of the 20th century, looks at the politicians, looks at the demagogues, looks at the great speakers of the 20th century, and you can see over and over again these people striving for all this power, and in their strive for power, as politicians or as these different kinds of leaders of revolutions, you can tell that they end up being hollowed out and soulless and essentially puppets to the very thing that allowed them to rise up to power, whether that's their constituency or the special interests, or whether that's the people of their movement or the ideology itself, or maybe just the hollow striving for power. That's what you get with these ringwraiths. They're a great image of that type of monster, this thing that was once a man and who wants to rise up, and in doing so sells his soul and becomes a puppet that doesn't get the blessing of getting to die, this long-lasting, stretched-out, immortal, hollow thing. You have power, but what good does it do? What good does it do if the man gained the whole world but lose his soul? Well, we get some very clear images that, you know, people of the past, they had many tyrants before, but, you know, did they consider, for instance, Julius Caesar or any of the Caesars soulless? Was Pharaoh soulless? No, they were tyrants, but it wasn't the same kind of empty puppet-like lack of will that you get with the ringwraiths. And so I think Tom Shippey makes a brilliant point there about how unique and how significant this new type of monster is that shows up in The Lord of the Rings. The Barrow-wights, in a different and more complicated way that I very clunkily tried to explain through a comparison to the Lincoln Memorial, kind of related to that, I guess. If you're gonna stretch that further, try to connect the two, well, what else could you do that would be horrible other than having a culture in which those who rise to power become like hollowed out, empty puppets, these soulless things without will, but they're the ones in power, aka these kinds of politicians that we deal with, both on the Allied and the Axis fronts, Tolkien would say. As he said, there are orcs on both sides of this war, as with all these modern wars. But in that world, where do the Barrow-wights fit in? What else could be wrong in a culture? Well, if you take things that were actually once great in our culture, things that were held onto because they had real value, and you tear those down and you imagine that they are possessed with actually not any sort of noble spirit or brave or courage or innovation, but instead just something evil and empty and of this in service of evil, then you get Barrow-wights, these things that were once great and now they've been repossessed by the spirit of evil. And then have we seen anything starting, say, in the 20th century that takes what were once noble elements of, say, Western culture and have been recast and the narrative retold so that all of these things were actually at their core just evil spirits? Whether you want to say tear down Shakespeare, for instance, tear down the Greek writers, tear down the Bible, tear down any of the politicians, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson types of things. And go, yeah, Thomas Jefferson might be a good example. Like, look, no matter what people thought about his greatness in the past, he was a slave owner, and worse than that, with his slaves, right? Well, that once that becomes the primary narrative of these things your culture held on to, then what you've just done is created Barrow-wights. And so you've got ringwraiths and Barrow-wights all around us. What do you do with them? Well, so maybe to the other point, a practical feature of this show is, what do you do if you actually have to fight one? For a Barrow, or for for a ring wraith, it's best to just run and get away from them, because they're not easy to deal with. Even great and powerful wizards like Gandalf are terrified of having to confront the Witch King himself. You can cry out to Elbereth Githoniel. As we're getting close to time, I'll let you figure out who that is, but that works for Frodo a couple of times. It's best just to not have anything that they want. But you could try getting on the other side of water. They have this deep fear of water, or maybe this limitation that they cannot cross it. At least not easily, not unless dryshod by a bridge or unless they're really pushed. So cross a river to get away from them, cry out to Elbereth Githoniel. They don't like fire wielded with courage. So grab you a torch and confront them with courage. They're not too good in the daylight, and they can't even really see because they live. They're these invisible wraith-like creatures that live mostly in the world of the unseen, or the wraith world. And so they can smell you, though. So if you can cover up your scent, run across a river, and cry out the right name, that's your best shot. Otherwise, you're in big trouble if they decide to come after you. And don't get captured by a Barrow White either. That's really awkward for everybody involved when you find yourself awake in one of their barrows. And you might not have Tom Bombadil to come save you, as he does the hobbits. So good luck to you if you have to confront either. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you made it this far, then you survived another edition. And so stay tuned to find out which kinds of monsters or what kinds of things we're going to talk about next time on The Monster Professor.